So whether we are long-term practitioners of the Buddha's teachings, or maybe fairly new to the Dharma, or maybe we're just curious and came here today to explore what it's all about, underneath all of those versions of why we're here, there's I think underneath the human mind, maybe sometimes playing in the background, is this deep wish to become or to participate in something much greater than ourselves. And through our curiosity and our explorations of the outer world, we find that we want to connect more and more into our inner world, which is where we have the possibility to then figure out what are the qualities that we need to cultivate in order to participate and add into something bigger than ourselves in this world. So we come together with maybe shared aspirations, maybe shared values as human beings, really wanting to affect positive change in our lives close to home and in the greater human family and living being family on our lovely planet here. So let's connect to that and keep our minds and hearts open and enthusiastic and delighted to be sharing with each other this possibility of growing our own good qualities and learning how to lessen or at least become more aware of those qualities of mind that get in the way of our capacity to participate and become part of something bigger. So let's connect with that. And may we do this, not only for our own peace of mind, not only for our own well-being and happiness, but by transforming our own minds and hearts, by extension, we will deeply affect the world and benefit all who come in contact with us. Welcome again on this somewhat spring day. We are starting a new chapter at Shravasti Abbey for sharing the Dharma because we are beginning a brand new book. And it's called Don't Believe Everything You Think. And I think that took me a while to figure out the cloud, but you know, when we look at clouds, they look like they're pretty solid from their own side. Mm. But if you've ever been up on a plane, of course, we know that that's not true, that they're just made up of some water particles and maybe some light refractions. But when we look at them, we're like, boy, they look, you could almost poke at them and they would not move. So I think the little analogy of don't believe everything, we think that some of the things that we think in our minds look pretty solid and pretty real and pretty concrete, but when we start looking at them a little bit more deeply, they're a little bit like this cloud on the cover of the book. I think this was put out, we got it here at the Abbey last summer, sometime?
Fall.
Fall. And what I wanted to do, when I offered to speak about this first verse that Venerable Chinny led that beautiful meditation on this morning, on precious human life, I went through the book and it's like there's 24 pages before you even get to that first verse. There's a whole introduction, and there's a chapter called Helpful Background. Mm. And there's some delightful things in here. So I didn't want to just jump into Precious Human Life with kind of going over some of the high points, which I happen to personally love prefaces and introductions because they say a lot about the author and what their motivations are. And so there are some real nice things that Venerable, she sort of sets the tone on why she did the book and kind of gives us an idea of what we're going to be hearing and learning about over probably the next few years, because there are 37 verses in here and we're going to do one this month, maybe longer than that. The book is a commentary on a root text by an amazing Tibetan practitioner called Tongme Sangpo, who lived back in the 14th century. And he was, as her book says, he was a bodhisattva, and he wrote a set of verses called the 37 Practices of Bodhisattvas. Now, bodhisattvas are beings who live in our world, who have been practicing the Buddha's teachings for eons, are growing in their capacity for wisdom and compassion beyond anything that probably right now most of us can imagine, and have made this deep vow to do this, to become Buddhas for the benefit of all beings. They're almost Buddhas, but they're not quite. And so Tome Sampo wrote this verse and practiced them through a large part of his life, and he made this as an offering to sentient beings so that we too, as we are bodhisattvas in training, in his deep wish that it benefits sentient beings. So that was back in the 14th century. And Venerable received the teachings, these 37 practices, from her teachers, the Dalai Lama, Geshe Sona Rinchen, and Kensur Jampa Taichok. And she said in the book that this is one of her main practices. So after so many decades of studying and practicing and meditating on the verses, I personally feel that she's quite qualified to give a commentary on it, of which this book is the commentary. And the book came about starting in 2005 when Venerable gave a short course on the 37 practices of bodhisattvas. And what's so remarkable, not only about this book, but about all of Venerable's books, is because she's a Westerner, she can take a lot of the Buddha's teachings, whether they come from, come from Tibet, which has its whole cultural coloration to go on to the Buddha's teachings, is that because she's a Westerner, she's able to put the 37 practices into a framework as far as language and concepts that we Westerners can understand, and that she translated in a very accessible and practical way so we can sort of grok it with the kind of language and slang and analogies that we use. So even though the text that she's doing this commentary on is 800 years old, she makes it sound so accessible, it's so relevant. And as she says in the book, 800 years ago, people still were under the control of ignorance and confusion and anger and attachment. They weren't much different than us. But the way in which she brings it forward so we can really adapt it to our lives is quite remarkable. And during the time that she was putting this book together, it took her a few years because she's doing a whole bunch of other things like training and being an abbess and traveling around the world giving teachings, is that she came up with this great idea that with each one of the verses, she would ask one of her students to think about their lives and difficult situations or insights that they've had and see if they could match up one of those situations with one of these verses. And so we had a period of time here, a number of us here at the Abbey have contributed to this book. Our names have been changed to protect our deluded minds, but we're in here, as well as a number of venerable students around the world. And so we sat around the lunch table for a number of days, kind of laughing, being happy, and being sad on how our minds cause us so much misery, and some of the silly things we've done, and some of the very tragic things we've done. And so in the course of the book, not only are there commentaries about the verses, but then she puts these little vignettes that her students have shared with her on how these verses have really come to life. And that's where, and by bringing her students' personal experiences in the book, I found that when I read the book that I connected with the teachings much more personally. So I have found that to be a beautiful addition to the book, is these little vignettes. And so then, how did she come up with this, this title, which I love it, Don't Believe Everything You Think, is that according to the Buddha's teachings, our minds are the source of happiness and suffering. And that the way that we, how we are, how we perceive the things that we experience in our lives, the way that we perceive ourselves, and the way that we perceive others, really influences the states of our mind. And that when we're not seeing things clearly and misinterpreting and misapprehending this experience of life, all these afflictions like anger and jealousy and confusion arise, which as a result of that, then we end up making ourselves miserable. We end up keeping peace very, very far away from our minds. And we really don't get to connect and benefit others, which is really what we want to do as human beings. And then we also keep ourselves from becoming the caring, compassionate people that we also aspire to become. And what she says, along with the title, is she says, you know, we really have to start challenging and bringing some very healthy doubt into these situations where our minds start to head in this direction, or we're in the middle of them, getting very, very perturbed and misunderstanding the experiences that we're having. She says, we have to start challenging them. Because there's a default mode that I think most human beings, that we get into these difficult situations. And what she says is that we need to hit the pause button and ask ourselves, is this the only way that I can resolve the situation? Is this the only feeling that I can be having? Is this the only words that I can be speaking? Do I have to box myself into a corner over and over again with the same default reaction? Because I know it doesn't work. I mean, it might work for a week. It might work in this relationship, but it's not resolved, it's going to come up someplace else. So that's where don't believe everything you think. She's kind of saying we've got to start challenging and have some healthy skepticism about the process of these, our minds, when they get stuck in these very unhealthy ways of thinking and the afflictions arise, and then we start acting and speaking and thinking in all sorts of ways that harm ourselves and others. And the 37 practices of bodhisattvas is all about giving up a total new way of thinking, that when you first read them, they sound absolutely undoable because they're so revolutionary. They're so outside our way of thinking on some level. But as we go through the book and Venerable does this commentary, you see that this is not only not as crazy as it sounds, but because it's totally opposite of what we've been doing since beginningless time, is that it actually works. And so this is the beauty of the book, is that Venerable shows what Tongme Sampo is offering to us as a whole new way of thinking that really brings us more joy, more compassion, more understanding in our present life, and to even grow more for the long-term motivations that we can actually attain awakening by transforming our minds in the way in which he evidently had, and what he's offering us the possibility to be able to do. And the best part of the book is that it's for everybody. You know, it's not just for people who practice the Buddhist teachings, whether we've been doing it for a long time or not for very long. This book is for people who are not Buddhists, too. And that it's basically, she says that there are two ways to consider the verses as she shares the ways to practice them. First is that we can use them to deal with the current difficulties in our life and to be able to be kinder, more compassionate human beings. And then she also says to take it even further above and beyond that, is to liberate ourselves from suffering and attain Buddhahood in order to help benefit and free all beings from suffering and to help guide them in the very same way that Tongme Sampo is offering to guide us with these verses. So that's the introduction. That's what she offers in the introduction. And the first chapter is called Helpful Background, which she basically explains some of the Buddhist worldview. So although it's not necessary to be a Buddhist to really benefit from this book, there are certain Buddhist worldviews like rebirth and karma, ignorance, Buddha nature, that are helpful to have some framework or some understanding about as you, you know, go along, as we go along with these verses, that will be helpful. So that's the first 24 pages that Venerable kind of sets the tone on the book. Okay, so I wanted to share that because that was a nice beginning. And then we go into the second chapter, is where we start with this first verse that Venerable Chinyin led us through, a very lovely meditation on precious human life. Having gained this rare ship of freedom and fortune, here think and meditate unwaveringly day and night, in order to free yourself and others from the ocean of cyclic existence. This is the practice of bodhisattvas. The first sentence after that verse, Venerable says, this verse is the summary of the entire path to awakening. That's an amazing statement. And that the very first step on this path is to recognize that we have this precious human life. And then, therefore, a very unique opportunity to hear, think, and meditate on the Buddha's teachings, which is pretty much encapsulates the entire path to awakening. We'll do the first part. Surprisingly, when Venerable did this part of the chapter on this verse, she spent a little bit on the general precious human life, but she really zoomed in on a particular set of them and then went on in great detail on how to really see them as a huge piece of how we can become awakened. As Venerable Cheney said, we have this rare ship, this human life of ours. Of the 7+ billion people on this planet who are humans, there are very few of us that have these particular features that constitute a precious human life. And what Venerable explains in a little bit more detail, which I'm always very helpful, it's always helpful for me, is that the Buddhist worldview is that there's not just the human realm. Just because we can't see these other realms of existence doesn't mean that they don't exist. The Buddha knows about them because of his omniscient mind. He describes them in detail in his teachings and says that there are realms that we cannot see that have the most unimaginable suffering, that the beings who live in those realms have absolutely no capacity to practice, no capacity to even think about the Dharma, because the suffering, the mental, physical suffering, is incredibly intense, unimaginable to us, even in our greatest destructive capacity here in our world. On the opposite side of that spectrum, he also says that there are these realms where, due to their karma, their virtuous karma, there are beings who live in this existence that the sensory and the mental pleasure is so intense, it is like a perpetual high, that they have absolutely no interest in practicing the Dharma. They're absolutely fine living in this basic God realm, to where they have all their needs met, they're beautiful, it's just nonstop pleasure. The precious human life that we have here, first of all, the human life, is the fact that we have a combination of just the right amount of suffering and just the right amount of happiness. That we have enough physical suffering, not the kind that can overwhelm us and kind of paralyze us to where we don't have any interest in practicing the Dharma, but just enough for us to realize, I am not liberated yet. I've got this crazy mind under the control of afflictions and karma, and I've got a body that is susceptible to aging, sickness and death, birth over and over again. So we have just enough suffering to keep us propelled to want to do something about that. On the other hand, we don't have so much sense and mental pleasure that we're totally distracted and totally disinterested in ever wanting to do anything about that either. So we have just enough happiness that we can really see that we've got a lot going for us, that we have a lot of good fortune, a lot of opportunity this life, that also makes us want to participate and to really, you know, increase that and to encourage that within ourselves and to see if other people can also have that same experience. So we've got this kind of interesting balance, somewhat a little bit more balanced towards suffering, sometimes a little bit more balanced towards the happiness part. So that's what most human beings have, is some version of that combination of suffering and happiness. But as Venerable Chuni led us through the meditation this morning on precious human life, we've got these other things that for those of us here in this room and not many millions more have these other qualities that make it even so rare and so precious, which is having the food, the clothing, the shelter, the medicine, which millions of people in this world do not have. We have support on our spiritual practice. Many people, millions of people, don't have anybody to talk to, have anybody to support them. We have our wits about us. We've got all of our parts. We have the ability to cognize, to think, to reason. We have a Sangha community. I mean, we're about as close as it can get to having a Sangha community in our lives. And we have not created any of those very heinous negative actions that totally obscure the mind to where you have no capacity to practice. So we have to continually, I mean, Venerable, she just wants to keep reminding us that we have to see that we've got something very, very special. And not only have we created all of that, but what she focuses in on is this remarkable fortune in that we have come in a time of the world's existence where the Buddha has appeared in our world. Evidently, since beginningless time, there have been world systems that don't have any Buddhas. There are world systems that have Buddhas and come and they just are incognito their entire life and they don't show themselves at all. Or they come and they teach some of the teachings, but they don't teach all of the teachings. So we have lived in what they call a fortune eon, where we've got the Buddha's entire teaching still in pure form in our world. And what she says that just kind of takes that and zooms it into a laser ray is that she says not only do we have the teachings, but the accessibility to them in our world right now is unprecedented. Due to the technology, the Skyping, the MP3, the live stream teachings, the audio, the web, and the amazing that you can get onto a plane and go anywhere on this planet within 24 hours and be sitting in front of a teacher who will give you the Buddha's teachings right there in present time. That we have this kind of access. We basically have had the Dharma presented on a silver platter. That's what we have right now. And that she says, let's not forget that. And let's not sit back and watch it go by. And so the second part of this, that we have this combination, just enough suffering, just enough happiness, these qualities of a precious human life. We have this treasure trove of Dharma that nobody ever has had, ever in their existence. And then not to, she kind of spells it out and says it's at our fingertips. So that's where the first verse, how she lines that up, is saying, this is what we have. And the second verse, she says, and therefore, hear, think, meditate unceasingly day and night. That's what Tongmei Salpo is saying. Little did he know that for 800 years after him, we would have this accessibility that he never had. And so she's saying, this is what we need to do because we have this accessibility, we have this unique opportunity, this life. And this is where she lays out in two or three pages what that means for us. I mean, she is so adamant that we don't blow it. And what the Buddha reminds us, despite the accessibility, he's saying, don't just take, however you're hearing my teachings, don't just take my word for it. Test it. Does this work? Put it under our scrutiny. Put it under our intelligent reasoning and say, is what the Buddha is saying, whether I get it through Skype, whether I get it in person from a teacher, whether I get it on MP3, is what I'm hearing, does it work? Can I use it in my life to really attain the temporal and ultimate happiness that I'm really aspiring for? And what the second verse is saying, if we truly want to attain what we're aspiring for, the happiness of this life and also full awakening, these three steps, hearing, thinking, and meditating, are how we're going to attain that. And we have spiritual masters since the Buddha's time on forward that have done exactly this. And they are realized, they're bodhisattvas, they're Buddhas. So we've got, I mean, it's just spelled out here. And then Venerable proceeds to go into detail on what hearing, thinking, and meditating actually mean. And that's what I wanted to share with you this morning with this beautiful, precious human life that we have. This is where she's focusing on this verse. First of all, hearing. And this doesn't mean just hearing with our ears, but this includes the books, the MP3s, the teachings in person, the live stream videos. Unlike at the Buddha's time and for centuries later, there weren't any books. Hearing was the only way you got it. You got oral transmission from teacher to student. So our capacity on what hearing actually means and listening has got a lot of different modes of how we can have access to that. What is crucial here is that she says that we need to hear the pure teachings. Because if we don't hear the pure teachings, we're going to invent some version of the path to awakening for ourselves, and we're going to have very, very different results. There's a lot out there that is not pure Dharma. There's a lot of other things going on. So she says we really need to explore and ask and check out and make sure that we're getting, when we do find the Buddhist teachings, that they are really indeed the pure teachings. And then she proceeds to go on and say from a very personal experience that she encourages us and says that receiving the Buddhist teachings from somebody in person, from a qualified spiritual teacher in person, we receive something very, very special that we don't receive from even live stream teachings or Skypes. There's something very, very special about that. And she really wants to share this with us. This is her personal experience. And knowing Venerable Chudun, as some of us do, the amazing practitioner that she is. And I think this is really where the connection is, why she is, because she has gone out of her way in her life to receive almost all of her teachings personally from her teachers. So this is what she says we will get to experience any time that we are willing to make the effort to go and receive teachings directly. First of all, she says that there is an oral transmission. Ever since the time of the Buddha, teachers pass on to their students verbally the texts and the teachings of the Buddha. So to be in the presence of a qualified spiritual mentor, we will get that oral transmission. Very powerful. Energetically, it's got 2,600 years behind it, and it comes right in here. That's the first one. We receive the teachings from someone who is actually practicing and actually knows how to practice and actually can explain to us how to practice. So there's an authenticity of being in the presence of someone who is actually walking their talk. And that we make a very strong heart connection with them in person, with this experienced practitioner, that can truly inspire us because they're living examples. The way that they talk, the way that they behave, and we can watch them. That's the beauty about being in the presence of some of these teachers. You can watch them like a hawk during the course of that weekend, and you watch the way they talk to the people, you can watch the way that they behave. If something unpredictable comes up, you see how they manage it. They are really the Dharma embodied. And when we're in their presence, we get to watch this, we get to witness it, and we get to be inspired by it. And we can also see and feel, and I know some of you have also experienced this, when we're in the physical presence of someone who has practiced and realized the Dharma, they exude this love. They exude this kind of compassion. It's like a vibe. And if you've ever gone to any teachings with His Holiness, you're in an auditorium with thousands of people, and He walks on stage, and you can feel Him. You can feel the depth of His practice. You can feel the depth of His wisdom. That's what you don't get anywhere else but being in the presence. If we have the fortune of having a teacher in our lives in a personal way, like we do here, we can have one-on-one, we can, you know, share our insights and our struggles, and they're there to correct. They're there to admonish if necessary. They're there to help us get away from this misguided way of thinking in a very personal kind of way, and, you know, situational things. And so if we, you know, which as time goes on, the access to the teachers becomes harder and harder. So as we have access to our teachers, it's an opportunity to really get some personal feedback and personal guidance. And after saying this, Venerable Dawn says, okay, so how different is that than you sitting home on your couch with a Coke and chips watching live stream teachings of His Holiness in New York? Is there a slightly different experience of what you're having as far as the impact on your mind, how much you're paying attention, how distracted you are, and that, and to check that out. And it's, and, you know, and to say, well, what's wrong with, you know, listening to tapes in the car and putting on my MP3 while I'm jogging and working in the wood shop? I mean, I have a very busy life, and at least I'm getting some of the Dharma in my life. You know, she agrees on some level with this, because there's a lot of us who don't have access to the Dharma. We live out in the middle of nowhere. We're 400 miles from whatever. And the only access we have is through the internet and through audio teachings and things. She says that's absolutely fine. And that's very reasonable for people who don't have access, either financially or geographically. But for those of us who have a choice. She says, you know, check out which mode of experience would you like to have when it comes to hearing about the teachings. And which do you think would have the greatest impact on your mind? And then and then she continues to talk about not only this preciousness of being in the presence of these qualified teachers, but that she also stresses that the environment in which we hear them has a lot to do with how well they go in and how deeply they go in. And that there's a big difference when we have to make effort to receive the teachings, that to come on retreat, to go to teachings, to have to arrange our lives, to have to figure out how to take off time from work, to be able to make some sacrifices to save money, so that we can arrange our lives because we really feel that this is precious and valuable. And when we put that much effort into going to teachings and making these sacrifices, she says when we finally show up, there's a lot more attentiveness and there's a kind of a cherishing of the experience more because we put so much effort into trying to get there. And many times there's huge obstacles that arise. It's not like we just make up our minds that we can get on a plane and leave. There's a lot of obstacles. So she says it's really worth thinking, you know, the effort is a huge part of almost the teachings going in a deeper way, more direct way. When we go to the temples, when we go to centers, and we go to monasteries, she says, sitting there, up straight, with your attention fully on the teacher. She says that has a lot to do with how the teachings go in. Lying in our beds, drinking tea, relaxing, doesn't provide the same presence of mind as sitting up in a center or in a monastery listening to teachings. Also, she says that there's something about sitting in a group of people that we're making a connection to other human beings who have shared values, that have probably gone through the same amount of arrangements and saving money and taking off the time from work or arranging their life so that they would be able to come to the teachings. There's a connection on shared values. And that also that as a group, we're creating a lot of virtue together. So we'll be able to practice and receive the Dharma in future lives together. There's a huge amount of virtuous karma we create in a group that's very powerful. She encourages and says that traveling to where the teacher is gets us outside of our comfort zone, away from our familiar surroundings, that we have ourselves totally present in the space rather than driving in our car where we're sort of watching the speedometer, we're kind of watching the traffic lights, we're watching to make sure a deer doesn't run out in front of us, or working in the workshop or jogging along the road. Our minds don't have the capacity to do two things at the same time. So although we may think that we're listening to the Dharma as we're driving in the car or we're working around the house, washing the dishes or cleaning, we don't have full presence of mind because no way that our mind can do it. Multitasking is a myth. We can't do that like they say that we can. Our minds aren't capable of that. So that's just the hearing part that she's sharing. Very important. The next piece is thinking. So we've heard the teachings, hopefully from a reliable spiritual teacher. And because we want to get a correct understanding, which requires the use of our logic and our reason, she says, then we take the teachings that we have heard and we start deeply reflecting on them using our reasoning and using our intelligence. And that there's a lot of confusion in our minds about what is going on around us, what things happen to us, how we respond to the world, and that the Buddhist teachings will help us to get a little bit clearer about what it is that we're actually seeing, what is it that we're actually experiencing, and the states of our minds. And that to add on to not just studying and committing to a formal study of the Buddhist teachings, that she really encourages us to talk to each other and to do group discussions and discuss with each other. It kind of keeps our minds open to other people's interpretations and other people's ideas. There's a lot of back and forth. We may be going along studying by ourselves, thinking that we're getting a good idea on what we're hearing. We might be making some not quite correct assumptions about the teachings. And by sharing with other people, we get to kind of mill over what we think we're hearing and then hear what other people's interpretations and ideas of the teachings are. And together, the growing of wisdom, not just for ourselves, but for a number of people, grows together. And I've also experienced that when we sit around here and do group discussion as a community, I learn to really appreciate the wisdom of the other people in the community, that they have done their own study and their own practice. I appreciate their scholarship. I appreciate their growing wisdom. And it also helps me to keep my mind open, that I don't know everything, and that it keeps me open and willing to hear other people's ideas and other people's processing. And so it really cultivates some good qualities in me besides just my power of reason and my power to figure things out. So that's a huge part, is to grow our wisdom by really getting a comprehension of what the Buddha taught. And then the third one, which is kind of the culmination of both hearing the teachings and then thinking and pondering them using our reasoning and using our intellect, is that then, which have a great impact on our minds, he doesn't want to discount that. But what we want to do eventually is not just have a conceptual understanding of the Buddha's teachings, but we want to have an experiential understanding of the Buddha's teachings. We want to get it beyond conception. We want to get into a direct experience or realization. And that along with these two steps, we then bring them into our daily meditation practice in a way to be able to integrate them in a deeper, more concentrated, focused way. And to bring this about, it's crucial that we set up a daily meditation practice. I mean, I don't know how many times I've heard this from her. I'm 14 years going now, and it's only until I came to the Abbey that I got it on why you have to show up every day and have some sort of practice, some sort of consistency. And that it gives us, what we're doing when we have a daily practice, is that we're actually treasuring the Buddha's teachings and our capacity to understand them by making the time and the space to be able to concentrate in a focused, undisturbed way sometime in the course of our day. And that what we have heard and studied and thought about, we now bring into the session so that we get it to where it's not just something that we've heard outside ourselves, but now it's something that we're beginning to hear and understand inside ourselves. And that it truly affects the way in which our mind thinks. So it's not just out there talking and listening, but now it's becoming part of our mind. It's becoming part of the way that we think. And that it becomes, after a while, so much a part of our view that when difficulties arise, or we want to undertake an activity, that there are these little points where the integration has become so deep that instead of the reaction being the default mode in the middle of the challenge, there's the thought of, this is karma ripening. Anger is not helpful. And this is why. I mean, it becomes, they actually start to sort of come up to the up into our minds. They're so present. We've been thinking about them so deeply that when we find ourselves in difficult situations, they actually become one of the ways that our mind goes to. That it becomes a little bit of a little segue from the general knee-jerk reactions and the afflictions that show up. And that's the power of meditation. And what I have found that this is, and what Venerable says, and what the Buddha has said, and what Tongmei Sampo says, is that this takes a lot of time. This is a slow process, hearing, thinking, and meditating. And what I have found over the years, there are certain Buddhist teachings that maybe it's my karma, maybe it's my dispositions, maybe it's my intellectual capacity, but when I put them through this hearing, thinking, meditating, they go in a lot more easily. Like I connect with them on some level that resonates a little bit sooner than the other ones, particularly the more difficult teachings of the Buddha that, you know, some of them I can do this with a little bit more easily. And so those are the ones that kind of encourage and inspire me for the more difficult teachings. And then, because if we don't do the meditating, we don't get ourselves on the cushion, and we don't try to integrate them into our life in an experiential way because of the meditating that we've been doing, that's sort of the byproduct of the deep concentrating and contemplating, is that no matter how much we know, no matter how much we think about, no matter how many debates we've had with our friends, if we don't take it and deeply focus on it in a contemplative way, we're never going to be able to have the capacity to realize them as an experience rather than just a conceptual understanding. No matter how much, no matter how many books, no matter how many degrees, no matter how many teachers we've gone to, if we don't take it to the cushion and we don't really deeply meditate on them, we're not going to really have the realizations that are required to really progress along the path and become these bodhisattvas that we want to be. And then, you know, to verify that this is not something that, you know, our teachers made up, that the Buddha, from the Buddha on up to our present teachers, this is exactly the process that they worked. It's not like this is 50 years old and we have to think about it. Hearing, thinking, and meditating is the process of attaining awakening that has been taught since the get-go. And we have great masters in all the Buddhist traditions, and we have great masters living in our world today that are realized beings because they've done exactly this process, this three-step process. So we have sort of a confirmation, a verification that this is not just sort of made up in somebody's mind, that this is something that has been tested over and over and over again. So that's kind of a source of inspiration, because this is a long journey here. The other part that the three-step process is important, particularly the meditation aspect, is that, you know, Venerable's got this part that she keeps, I mean, she says this so many times, and she does it because it's so important, is that to understand what meditation is. You know, it's not sitting in the cushion with our eyes closed. She says that's what the body's doing, sitting there. That's the body thing. What you want to do is, meditation's all what the mind's doing while you're sitting like this. This supports meditation. That whole body scan, that Venerable Chinyere, that's very supportive of what the mind is doing. But you can sit like this, and you could be, you know, daydreaming about who knows what. So we've got to put the body to support what's going on in the mind. And what the mind is doing is what meditation is. And that, if we don't learn the correct way to meditate, we'll end up inventing something, which means the result will reflect that. Or if we're going to invent what we think meditation is, we're not going to get the results of awakening. We're not going to get the results of really a deep growing of our happiness and our peace and our wish to benefit. And Venerable shares also, you know, this continual confusion with a lot of her students is that she gets these emails and people say, I listen to music while I meditate. What kind of music should I use? Or I meditate while I'm swimming. Or I meditate, you know, while I'm hiking the Great Divide. And she said she's not sure what these people think meditation is, but as far as she knows, none of the great sages have put this on the recommendation of how to meditate. Meditation isn't swimming, isn't listening to music, isn't hiking on the Great Divide. Now, we may experience some relaxation and calmness from swimming, from, you know, listening to music. But if we want to become awakened, that's not going to get us there. And then she segues right into that line there says, hear, think, and meditate day and night unwaveringly. And then the first response for most of this is, you mean we don't ever get to sleep? That we've got to do this like 24/7 because this life is so precious and I don't want to waste a moment. Therefore, I'm going to do my best to just do this unceasingly day and night. I'm going to be sleep deprived, but I'm going to try it. That's not what this means. We need rest. What this part refers to is using even our going to sleep, which we all do and we all love to do, I'm sure, as a virtuous activity. As we're falling asleep, is to think about the three jewels, to think about rejoicing at any kind and wise actions that we've done with our body and speech during the course of the day. When she goes to sleep at night, she imagines she goes on her right side and she puts her hands like this, and she imagines her head being on the lap of the Buddha. And that's how she falls asleep. So that our going to sleep becomes a virtuous activity rather than falling into our bed with these deep, oh, God, thank God, you know, and snuggling in and getting all attached to our comforter and our blankies and things like that, is to make it a totally virtuous activity rather than making it an object of attachment. And saying, now, this is happiness. may I rest well. So when I wake up tomorrow morning, may I be able to continue to practice and to benefit people and to transfer my mind. It takes about, well, I've tried it a few times. I don't do it very well, but it takes about 30 seconds. It takes about a minute. And my mind's just so happy when I take the time to do this. And we do it a lot in our lives. So we might as well use it as a virtuous activity. And then, so why are we practicing hearing, thinking, and meditating as much as possible? And we move on to the third line, which is to free ourselves and others from the ocean of cyclic existence. So it's not to be a great yogi or yogini so that people will be impressed with us and give us money and give us food and write about us in magazines. It's not to liberate ourselves alone. It's not to escape the world. It's not to go into hiding and isolate ourselves so we can become Buddhas for, I don't know, somebody. But I'm too, you know, caught up in meditating up here on some lonely mountain somewhere or in some monastery somewhere. And that's not what the purpose of hearing, thinking, meditating is about. Inside our hearts, we are cultivating the motivation to free ourselves to become Buddhas so that we can lead and free others, so that they can also become Buddhas. To cultivate bodhicitta, that big mind that aspires to benefit everyone without exception. That's really why we're working so hard. That's really why we're working through countless great eons. Not for ourselves. Not for some high. Not for some status or reputation or offerings or bliss. We're doing it so that we can really free all these suffering mother sentient beings who have been our moms and dads and sisters and brothers since beginningless time. And the two last pieces is that when we look at the steps on how to practice and we get a sense of how deep, how profound, how important, how rare, and how long the journey is, we do it, and you hear that, you know, to become a Buddha takes a very, very long time. Why would we go through all of this trouble just for ourselves? I mean, really think about it. Why would we go through all of this profound, deep, and difficult work on our minds just to do it for our own benefit? It seems like a pretty small reason for such a vast journey. And that's sometimes really worth contemplating, you know? And that's what gives us the impetus, gives us the joy, gives us the fuel to keep showing up, to hear, think, and meditate, is that we're doing this for everybody. You know, if we're going to go through all of this, why not do it for every living being without exception? That seems to fit the trajectory. You know, that fits what the Buddha has shared, what the Buddha offers, what Tongme Sampo, what Venerable offer to us, benefiting all sentient beings to go through as long as it takes. The trajectory fits if we say we do it for ourselves and for others. And then finally, the last piece is that it takes time. Tongme Sampo points out the way, and we head in that direction slowly and purposefully. Venerable says, be very, very careful that you don't try to do it right. That we don't try, okay, you know, I got to get it right. Or that we give ourselves a hard time from not getting it from the get-go. I mean, there are all sorts of obstacles we can set up thinking that we've got to be someplace else than where we are. And also she says, to be very, very careful. We have this beautiful, precious life. We give it everything we have, considering our circumstances, considering our karma, considering our predispositions. We do the best we can. And to really rejoice. Remember that we are training our minds. It requires a lot of effort. It requires a lot of familiarity. It requires a lot of repetition. And a very expansive view, seeing how our efforts will benefit not only us, in the short term, but us in the long term as well as everybody else. And to have a very healthy sense of humor. And that's one thing you can see all these great sages and these great masters, at least the ones living today, they have the most incredible senses of humor. I mean, it's just their faces light up. They love to laugh at themselves. And, you know, if you're one of their students, they love to laugh at us too. They have a great sense of humor. It's a long road. And it's worth every step of the way. And this is the practice of bodhisattvas. And all of us are bodhisattvas in training. That's what I kind of garnered from this first verse. It's only half the second chapter. But there's a lot in it. And it speaks so much to me of Venerable's practice. And that she can translate it so we can understand it. I find that this book just put me over the edge when I read this. I mean, she's got it. She's got it nailed. And because she's got that bodhicitta motivation, she's just giving it away. I mean, she's in Portland this weekend. This is why she's there. She wants to share. That's what I had to share. And, kind of funny, and kind of coincidental, a few minutes here, is that those little vignettes I was telling you about that come at the end of these teachings, there's two of them here at the end of the Precious Human Life. One is called By Pat, Renewed Appreciation for Life, and one called Roy, No Dogma for Me, which is lovely because when he thinks about the hearing, thinking, and meditating on the teachings, he tries very hard to avoid forming hard and fast opinions that that we then assert as absolutes. Thus, the only time I can honestly say that I'm absolutely right is when I'm saying I'm not sure I know. So what he shares in this little vignette is that the more that I study the Dharma, the more I realize that I am not certain about anything, nor do I fully understand anything. So he said he got quite a lesson in humility when he read this first verse, and that's what he put in that he shared. And then the other one, I'm going to go ahead and expose myself, that the renewed appreciation for life path is Senkei. That it was an experience that happened many, many years ago with me and my sister out on Lake Pendere, that we almost died that day on a little boat. We got in over our heads out there on Lake Pendere, and the wind came up, and we almost capsized. And it was quite a scary day, but looking back on it, I realized that as much as we have a precious human life, all it takes is a slight change in causes and conditions, and that precious human life can basically be gone for good. Any questions or comments before we close? Helpful? So I do, we have some of these books in the house. I do encourage, lovely. And you can just do a little piece at a time. It's not like you got to read chapter at a time. They're pieces at a time. So let's just spend a few minutes and do a little bit of digestion meditation, and then we'll dedicate.